Months ago that the thing that we've been talking about and dreaming about all at once suddenly emerged as reality. And what we were talking about is free energy. A simple device that just sits there and runs and will produce all of the energy you can need for your home. And it's not a dream anymore. It is a reality. And I am so very glad to have in studio with me tonight three of the men who have been very, very instrumental in bringing that about, and another whose work has gone on for many years to bring that and other areas of a new kind of science to the fore. Tom Bearden, welcome to Open Mind tonight.
Well, it's nice to be here, Bill.
And along with you is Mr. John C. Bedini.
Welcome, Bill.
And Mr. Stephen Wirth, who's sitting next to him.
Yes, Bill.
That's the nuts and bolts man over there, and Dr. Bob Beck.
Oh, Bill.
Very glad to have all of you aboard, and we want to have a freewheeling discussion tonight about science, I guess it is, about free energy. But, Tom, I think this thing of free energy has sparked the imagination of the KABC audience and the audience of our Let's Talk magazine. I had a little article about John Bedini in it. We had enormous responses to that. And I think, John, you did, too.
Yeah.
Over there. And certainly you, Tom, have electrified the Open Mind audience now for many, many years. You've been working with John. We've talked about it before. Is that free energy here?
It's here. It's for real, Bill.
What is that going to do to the way we live, to the way we work, to the way we govern ourselves, to world politics?
Well, we hope that it will indeed be something that will free an awful lot of mankind. If you look at our problems we have today, energy, the cost of energy, enters into the cost of everything we do, everything we make, everything that we have to pay a price to buy, to afford, the standard of living we're able to achieve. If we can have cheaper energy, we can certainly have a higher standard of living for everybody. If we can have a very cheap energy that's easily portable, no matter where you are in the world, let's say into some far-flung third-world country where there aren't any roads and there aren't any railroads, back into the little villages way back in the hills, you can certainly better the life of everybody, even people like that. So it'll touch everybody's life if we can actually get this out and get cheap energy out to everybody. It'll increase everybody's quality of life throughout the world.
One of the things we often hear is they are not going to let you do that. They, who are they talking about? The power bases, the oil companies, or whatever. What do you feel about that? We've seen it happen in the past. We could have had free energy around the turn of the century. It was stopped then by the theys. What about now? What's going to stop that, stop them from stopping this from happening?
Well, of course, they're still around, this mysterious they. And they're certainly not taking too kindly to the fact that we're trying to get it out. There are at least four or five working model free energy devices in the United States today. I think, however, I'm very hopeful because I think we have a window that we've not had before. I think, you know, it seems that there have been, some 50 or 60 people in the United States alone over the last few decades who have actually stumbled onto or invented what we call free energy motors. None of them have been successful in getting it out, even if they had a motor that worked. I think we have a change that's occurred where we have a window that we can get it out. And I think the reason is that this they has made a serious mistake. Quite bluntly, they've loaned out a lot of money to third world countries and throughout the world, and even communist countries, that can't even pay the interest on the loan, much less pay the loan. And they openly admit this now. And they openly admit to some $800 billion or so dollars that have been loaned out in that fashion. You know, you name your own figure. The blunt point of it is that money, or an awful lot of that, is going to come out of the American taxpayer. And make no bones about it, we are going to pay that. You're not going to have any choice about that. Fine, but you cannot kill the goose that lays the golden egg. You have to at least feed the goose. It appears that they've got to give somewhere. And the simplest place to give is to allow a very cheap utility bill for the average family and for industries and so forth. This would free up an awful lot of money, which can then be taken on the taxes and so forth like that, and provide the money which can then be given to various and sundry international organizations and reloaned or given to the countries to pay the bills. So it's a kind of a distribution of capital, enforced distribution of capital procedure, but in so doing it, they're going to have to feed the goose. And in feeding the goose means, I think, that for the first time in the last 80 years, you will be able to provide means for cheap utilities and not get your head chopped off. At least that's the guys that are the sales that we're going on. And so we're trying very desperately to get out a device that will produce energy very cheaply for the home and later for power units that are bigger for factories and industries and so forth. In other words, we're shooting for the power that feeds utilities. You won't put the utility companies out of business. That's not the purpose. Not everybody would be able to afford a device like that, even if it were only $2,000 or $3,000. Not everybody could afford that. But if your utility bill were to drop to $10 or $15 a month, let us say, then the little old lady down the lane that's on a Social Security check could certainly afford to turn her heat up in the winter and not freeze like she's having to do now. And that's what we really want to do.
Are you finding any kind of resistance to this idea?
We're finding a lot of harassment, a lot of disbelief, of course, which we expected, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That is not unexpected at all. And let me address the primary reason for the disbelief. There's an old adage about conservation of energy. Most people who use that term don't even know what energy is, as a matter of fact. So I want to be very precise tonight, and I know this is all going on tape. I know people will hear this in the future. And so I want to say some things that are very precise and rigorous. Now, rigorously, energy is defined as the power to do work. Work, rigorously, is defined as a single force moving against a resisting mass. Now, the key here is a single force. Not two, not three, not 500,000. One. Rigorously, if you have a system which uses multiple forces opposing each other so that they sum to zero, a zero vector resultant, you cannot apply the term energy to that system because the resultant force is zero and it doesn't exhibit any energy externally. But it can have enormous energy locked in on each little vector inside it that's making up the zero. Since I know some technical people are going to be listening to the tapes and to this broadcast, let me accent that a zero vector is not nothing. A zero vector is a system of other vectors which are continuing to act. They can be going bananas down inside the zero. And they can be deterministic. They don't have to be chaotic. So when you make a zero vector system, which nothing in electromagnetics out there teaches you to make, you have made a magic system indeed. If you know how to use that artificial zero, that zero vector, that artificial potential, you can warp space-time, bend space-time, which is just a potential in the first place. Now, to finish out the technical portion, and then I'll shut up so somebody else can talk. But I have to finish this idea while we've got it going. If I produce such an artificial potential, such a vector zero, the energy that's locked inside that is now no longer what we call energy. And we have changed the constitution of the vacuum across our system. We have bent space-time in the system. We are now not in special relativity at all. We're in general relativity. And if you will read your physics book, you will find that a general relativistic system, if you create one, does not conserve energy. And so what we're saying already exists in the physics book, if you believe general relativity. Now, if you don't, you ought to quit teaching it and you ought to throw the book away. So all that you do is you make an artificial potential, a zero vector system. You make a lot more of it in one part of the system than you got in the other. Everybody is supposed to know that a difference in potential creates a little river in the virtual state. And that is something you can tap and get energy from. And that's all we do. It's no more mysterious than having a river that nature is very kind to provide for you if you're clever enough to open the gate for the dam so that the river will flow. And then you put a paddle wheel in the river. That's all we're doing. It's just as simple as that. And you can do it. And it is perfectly permissible by the physics we already have in the textbook. It's just that they never taught you to make zeros.
Well, it seems like that along came a device that makes zeros. And we'll talk about that device in just a moment and the young man that put it together. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. It's past nine on a Saturday night. It's Open Mind, and we're talking about free energy. In studio with me is Mr. Tom Bearden, who has been on with us many, many times. John Bedini is here, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about finding a system that would create this zero energy. It was found here not too long ago. Is that true?
That's true, and the young man that found it is sitting right to my right here, named John Bedini.
John, did you realize that you were doing all of that whenever you put together this little fascinating device of yours?
Yes. I want to kind of explain to the people out there how I did this. I was very curious about free energy, and also I was very curious about what Dr. Tesla's experiments were in the beginning. So I contacted the Tesla Book Company. And John Rasloff up there told me that there were some books out on free energy. Well, being a conventional trained guy all these years, I says, oh, well, that's poppycock. That can't be done. Because you can't ever get, you have to put so much work in to get so much work out. So what I did was I ordered these books. And three of those books kind of got me really going, and those were Thomas Bearden's books, especially in the electromagnetics and in the proofs of the free energy. And what I did was I set out upon a quest to, here was a man who sat there and he wrote all these books and he found all the errors, as far as I could see, because I really, from day one, basically never went along with what you call conventional engineering or conventional electronics. So here I sat all alone in my lab one night, and I had made a phone call to Tom the day before, and I said, Tom, is this exactly what you want to see reproduced in a motor? And he says, well, if you do that, then that motor should run. So I stayed with him on the phone for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Of course, paying that great big phone bill.
We run up some real big ones.
But well over a couple hundred dollars a piece. But that's the price you have to pay for when you're in quest of something. So what I did was I reconstructed, not actually, there might be a better term for this. What I'd actually done was built what they called a pulse magneto. And I built a little oscillator that drove a motor in the form of a pulse. And what this did was pulse the motor for about one-third of its rotation. Then, on the second half, it was just like taking a lawnmower magneto, and I sent this back to the battery. However, after many, 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 many hours, I found out that I still didn't have any free energy, and the motor died. So I began to look at it a different way. I said to myself, you see, what I was looking for was the movement of electrons through the wire. In other words, what I was trying to measure was a current, something that every engineer wants to measure through this wire. If you don't have any current, you don't have any amps, that you would call it, and if you don't have the volts in the current, you don't have the watts. So therefore, I said to myself, wait a minute. What I'm dealing with here is something that's real special, and there's no current involved, because where you get the current is inside the battery after these two waves couple, so it's something you can't measure. So what I did was I tinkered around with this thing for maybe 15, 20 hours more, and all of a sudden I walked out of my lab one day, and I went out to do my general repairs, and I come back, and this darn thing was still running. I said, well, wait a minute. What's wrong here? What's going on? I said, that should have been dead hours ago. I didn't think anything about it. I just locked the door and left. But when I come back, this darn wheel was still turning, the motor was still going, and the battery was reading 13.5 volts, sometimes 14 volts. And I noticed that the battery was bubbling away as if it was in a discharged state. However, that was not the case because the meter was reading that the battery was full. So I stopped the machine, and I walked away for an hour. And I come back, and I measured that battery again because I figured, well, maybe it's just a disturbance on the digital meter that I had. So I walked away from this for about an hour, and I come back and I measured the battery again, and sure enough, I did everything I could do. I took light bulbs, I put them across the battery to see if the battery had the power in it or whether the meter was lying to me. Well, sure enough, the battery had the power in it, and when I reconnected the machine back up again, I started to notice the waves that were on this machine. And one very particular thing about this wave was that the speed made no difference at what the wheel was turning. The amplitude of this wave stayed the same no matter what speed until the darn wheel just quit flat dead. Well, after that, I wore the bearings out in the machine. I made other tests. I never could get the machine, and this is a very truthful and honest statement, I never could get the machine back in time again. So I said to myself, well, this is much too critical for anybody to build. It's going to be a tough project. However, what I did do was prove out that Thomas Bearden's theories were absolutely correct. And so I wrote a little book about it, and I put down the waves which I had seen in this book. However, I started to search for machines and generators that had this effect of no drag when loaded. Well, you can go through every engineering book in the world and find yourself hours after hours, and every generator that you construct is going to have drag on it. Well, there was one in particular that I noticed. And so I constructed a very small model of this particular type of energizer. And I noticed that when I shorted this generator went faster. I did notice one strange, peculiar thing in the measurements, that if I put a 4-ohm load, and any engineer that's out there is going to agree with me, that if you have 30 volts of power, and you square that power and divide it by the load, that's going to be the watts that you have. So I did notice that with this particular generator, the lower the load impedance was, the less this generator would want to put out. Well, I said, okay, that's fine. That means that this generator could only be 36 watts at the power which I was putting across there at the time. However, I noticed something very strange. I put a 100 ohm resistor on there, or I put a 10,000 ohm resistor on there, and all of a sudden I had 500 watts or 600 watts. I said, well, this is absolutely backwards.
Well, the more load you had, the harder it worked, then.
Well, the more load I had in terms of low resistance, the less work the machine did and the faster it went forward. In other words, this is something that
backwards.
It's backwards. It's completely backwards machine. So I noticed one strange thing. That when this generator was connected through a bridge rectifier, and that rectifier was going to the battery, that the output from the generator, there was something that wasn't exactly right, and the performance of this generator was limited. So I started to do some very strange measurements. I found out, number one, on the first test that I made with this generator, that the generator had 100 volts of power across the rectifier at exactly 16 amps of power. Now, anybody in their right mind is going to calculate that out and tell you that that's 1.6 kilowatts, without a question of a doubt. However, the engineer measuring this said to me, John, you can't do that because number one, you're not using a full-wave bridge. I said, okay, here's a full-wave bridge. Let's do it again. He says, okay, I'm very tempted now, John, to subtract the battery voltage, which means that your generator is only 46 watts. So that's fine with me. However, I just want to clarify one point out here right now at this time. If that's true, and that's the true, accurate way that measurements are made, then everybody out there that drives a car should never turn on their headlights, because their alternators aren't capable of supplying that power back to the battery if the conventional measurements are right. Because if you subtract the battery voltage from the full-wave rectifier, then that means that you would have maybe 16 amps of power at 4 volts, and anybody can tell you that's not enough wattage to keep your headlights going. So that right there, that was a very strange measurement to me, and it led me to believe that this type of machine likes a half-wave rectifier more than it likes a full-wave rectifier, and it was without a question of a doubt, the battery was charging and bubbling faster with a half-wave rectifier than it was with a full-wave rectifier. Well, I did some more experiments on this, and I found out that these engineers and the people that wrote the textbooks have very conveniently did things to make things not last so long. And one of these things that I want to talk about is the rectifier, for example.
All right, I want you to talk about that in just a second. I want to take a little break here, John, as you're going on and developing something that is totally new. It works totally backwards. It works contrary to conventional electronics and understanding of it. And I think just now, as Tom did a little bit earlier, is trying to put that in focus, in that all of the science actually is there. It's just never been tapped before, basically, isn't that what you're saying?
It's scattered across about four different areas in science that haven't been well put together. For example, quantum mechanics and relativity, there is no proper consolidation of the two or union of the two yet in physics. The best attempt at that is called quantum field theory, and quite frankly, it hadn't cut the mustard yet.
Yeah. We're not going to be... We're trying to put all of this into language that Bill could understand, gang.
Well, in other words, what he has a machine that if you try to measure inside the machine where there are different kinds of electricity from the kinds that we normally know, and I tried to get at that with the idea of what a zero vector really was.
Mm-hmm.
If you're moving that energy when it's locked inside a zero, the conventional instrument, if you had a good, perfect zero, would measure zero current down the wire, and you could be moving enormous amounts of energy, but it's a different kind. It's locked in as a zero, and your instrument won't measure it.
So this is a whole new thing for the scientific community to think about. They better think about it,
yeah.
Because it's happening.
David Baum's term for that is enfolded. It's been enfolded against itself, and so you'd say it's in a special kind of vacuum or whatever.
Well, it's going to be that kind of night on Open Mind. Science is going to have to take a new turn as a result of the work that all of you have done. We want to get into Steve Wirth and his contribution here in just a second. It's Open Mind on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins. You know, from all indications...
Guy a sketch, and he visualizes this three-dimensional right away. I've never seen anybody in my whole life grind out arcs it requires $2,000-$3,000 worth of tooling just to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen Steve actually take nickel iron magnets and grind them to a perfect arc without shattering them. And it beats me, Bill. I mean, he's just an unusual guy. Usually when you take a magnet and you hit it against a flywheel, you know, it chips, it cracks, but not Steve's. Steve's came out perfect art. And I says, well, Steve, what's your secret for this? He says, I can't tell you everything, John. I'll help you do it, though. But no, Steve is a real exceptional guy in that he visualizes things without having the orthodox training. In other words, there is nothing clouding his imagination.
I don't know, I've listened to the two of you talk, and I've listened to the three of you talk, and it's amazing to see how you're tossing around the theories of Tesla and Moray and all the rest of them. All of you, you know them. You're developing your own, and then you're putting it into hardware, in coming up with the devices. Steve, what did you think the first time you looked at John Bedini here and that gizmo in his laboratory?
Well, when I first seen it, I looked at it. I thought it was impossible somebody would ever have free energy. So I looked at it, and I knew there was something unusual. It was different. You know, something about it I didn't know, but I knew it was different than anything I'd seen before. So I got interested, and we started talking. So I says, why don't we make a bigger model? And John says, okay. He says, well, I said, don't worry. I says, I got the machines. We can make a bigger one.
We should say, Steve, you have a big machine shop there in the valley.
Right.
Okay.
So anyway, he's telling me how he'd like to have one made. And so we made a few sketches here and there. And so that's where we went. Then I went back to the shop and made the little parts he needed. And we had to put some coil winding on some of them parts. And we did some experiments. And that's how we developed it up to a bigger point. Well, and then the more I'd watch him, then I'd say, well, we ought to change this. And then he'd look at it and say, hey, yeah, it's a good idea. Stuff like that. Then we'd develop it to a better machine.
Well, we call these two the technobrats, Tom, by the way, because they sit there and say, hey, why don't we do this? And why don't we do that? The next thing you know, they've got arcs flying, electricity going, and wheels turning, and lights turning on and turning off, and they're not using any electricity at all. They're lighting up the whole world out there with their free energy device. Sitting to your left is Dr. Bob Beck, who's been deeply involved in scientific research of many, many different kinds. Bob, I know you've been out to see the Bedini device. In your estimation, are the technobrats doing it?
Well, one thing that absolutely amazed me was the day that Ed Skilling and I were out there, as John said, the amplitude of his output on the coils was totally independent of the rotational velocity, which is against the law.
Against the law.
Against the law.
Not supposed to do that.
And that captured my undivided attention. I've seen over the last 40 years dozens and dozens and dozens of these, and it looks like we finally have one that's going to work. There were so many flaws in the undershot, the T. Henry Moray, the Fuson. I've known many of these people personally, but it looks like it's here.
And it's doing some very strange and phenomenal things. I know the one that I have looked at, you hardly are using any kind of wire at all. It's number 30 wire to move your electricity. Well, that's smaller than a hair.
Yeah, a little bit bigger. It's about 10,000 in diameter if you put it on a micrometer, use a micrometer.
But with that, you're lighting a 1,000-watt heater,
right.
A quartz heater. Now, ordinarily, a strand of wire that size would burn up instantly, wouldn't it, Bob?
Yeah, it should.
But it doesn't. Now, Tom Bearden, why doesn't it burn up?
Well, when it goes through that little wire is still internal to the circuitry. And if the machine were making a perfect zero, there would be an absolute, to the conventional instrument, there would be an absolute zero current going through that wire. What amount of current you do measure is the lack of perfection in the zero, because you can't make a completely perfect zero. You do have some spillage and some leakage. And so you measure a little current, but the most of the energy that's going there is in the locked-in form, and it's not, the wire doesn't think anything very much is going through it, because it's going through it in a different fashion, in a different form from what normally passes as current through it. Now, when this hits the coil on the other side, like in the case of the quartz, or when it hits the inner workings of the light, for example, the zero comes unglued. It spills out every which way, and all the pieces, all the little vectors that have been churning away in there like mad now are churning away independently and making real usable energy. And I might add that, you know, when we say we bend space-time, you bend it in one place up and it goes down in the other place. And so what the machine is really doing, the river that's being of energy that we're tapping, you'll find that the machine is taking energy from its surroundings. Otherwise, it gets pretty cold around a machine. And that's where the energy is coming from. In other words, overall in the universe, the energy is still conserved. It's in that local region that we're violating the conventional conservation of energy. But it's no more than the fact that, you know, we have a little river in that area and we're tapping the river.
Are you really violating the conventional conservation of energy, or are they just going to have to change the conventional?
They're going to have to change it, because the assumption now in the conservation of energy law is that your vacuum stays linear.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do anything to change space-time across the system you're using. That's a hidden assumption in the conservation of energy law. In special relativity, you don't change the vacuum. In general relativity, you do. You have a curved space-time. And so, as is well known in general relativity, energy is not conserved if you have such a system. And here we are deliberately making that kind of system. And we believe that, so we make it. So John's making that. It turns out all these crazy experimenters that were trying to do that, the Hooper coils, for example, and the Hooper patents, were a good example of a guy who understood to make zeros. He was bucking things against each other. He was making these zeros. And he got weird effects. And there's a whole history of people who didn't maybe put it in these kinds of words, but they were doing that. They stumbled around and tinkered around until they did that, and they got some results. And if we can make it very clear, the results are obtainable. They can be accomplished on a laboratory bench, and you can get energy. Nature has been very kind. The energy is there in an unusual form. So you've got to have an unusual approach to unlock the energy. And that's what John's machine is doing. And he's built several of them. He doesn't have just one. There are several
of them. No, every time you turn around, he's got a new one going.
Every time you turn around, he built one.
Tom, we heard the other day that someone had broken a patent loose in the patent office. Was that Joe Newman?
Yes. Let me say, you know, unequivocally, that Newman does have a device which will run itself and charge batteries. He does have a proof-of-principle device working there. He certainly demonstrated that to a substantial number of scientists who've gone down there and checked the machine and have signed affidavits that it does do exactly that. And they've run it long enough to ascertain that it's sufficient for proof-of-principle. Well, what happened was Joe has sued the patent office because the patent examiner before would not award a patent. In fact, they have not yet, in fact, awarded the patent. When he got to court, the judge said something like, well, I'm not an expert, but let's have a special master, they call it, a recognized expert in this area of energy devices and so forth that both sides could agree on, and then let the special master investigate this and come back and recommend to the court. Well, they did that. And the special master came back, and essentially he recommended, as Bob was pointing out, that there had been proof of principle shown, and that the previous patent commissioner was, in fact, biased, obviously biased, against this, and had revealed himself to be a biased examiner. And the special master advised the court that, you know, the patent ought to be issued and they ought to get a new examiner who was not biased.
I think he said to somebody, he says, I don't know how it works, but I do know that it is.
Well, he pointed out that it's not necessary to understand how it works. The law calls for demonstrating the principle. And then that's sufficient for a patent, even if you can't understand how it works, if you can demonstrate it does. So the situation it's apparently in right now is the judge sent it back to the patent office following the recommendation of the special master and told them essentially to get a new examiner who wasn't biased and look into this thing with a view towards issuing a patent. And I expect he'll be given a patent.
So we have free energy coming down the line, not only from John Bedini, but from Joe Newman. It's yet to be determined how much work the Newman device will do, other than proving that the principle works.
Well, he has certainly proved the principle. There's no question about that. His device does prove the principle.
So free energy is our subject. And if you'd like to get in on this conversation, you've got four men here who certainly know their way around it. You're getting quite an education. Your numbers are... Let's open up the phone lines to you guys. You ready to field them? Because there are a lot smarter ones out there than me to ask you questions. And there may be some skeptics who are not sure that you know what you're talking about. And hopefully they'll get in here, too, and put you on the hot seat if you're ready. All the numbers end in TALK, T-A-L-K, in Los Angeles, 520-TALK, in the San Fernando Valley, 990-TALK. If you're in Pasadena, Glendale, and Burbank, your number is 244-TALK. Out in the San Gabriel Valley, 44A-TALK. South Bay, you're 679-TALK. Long Beach, San Pedro, Downey, Linwood, Compton, that area, 639-TALK. If you're in Orange County, in the 714 or the 619 area code, 750-TALK. And if you're in the 213 area of Orange County, call us at 448-TALK and talk to Tom Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, or Dr. Bob Beck. You know, there's nothing to Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Dr. Bob Beck. And on the line we have Ramon. Okay, Ramon, what's on your mind tonight?
Well, we're in the subject of free energy and the theories of Tesla, Tom Bearden, and Moray, and all the distinguished guests that are on your program tonight. I'd like to point out that this field, as it is now and will continue in the future, and it's probably been discovered in the past in ancient civilizations is probably more likely to affect human mind than any mechanical system or invention as far as generating electricity. The simple fact is that it's inner space that we're tapping. And, of course, the mind is part of that domain. Now, I would like to ask a question to Dr. Bob Beck and then Tom Bearden. First of all, Dr. Beck, you recently released the theory of Dr. Tesla on his death ray using minute particles. And you pointed out that it had nothing to do with his transmission of electrical power. And, of course, von Bierman has come up with the theory that scalar waves were, in fact, discovered by Tesla, and that both of these systems are different, yet they're the same. I have a case in point. In the words of Tesla, he did invent the death ray as a particle. Then later on he said that he superseded the original invention and had a new working system, which could explain the scalar device. Now, maybe there's some more information that my two colleagues have can share with the audience concerning this.
Okay, Ramon, it was a rather incredible story. Back shortly after his death, a chap who was in charge of FDR's Buck Rogers squad, he was a Canadian citizen who had an IQ up around 200, realized that Tesla's effects were going offshore, where FDR's friend Stalin could pick them up by way of Yugoslavia. And he had the good sense to microfilm a number of the Tesla papers, which had never seen the light of day until the Psychotronics Conference this year, when I decided to go ahead and release this material. He left these papers with me in trust about 25 years ago, and so we showed this device, which was basically a very high-voltage electrostatic generator, as only Tesla could build of this quality, and it was basically the forerunner of the particle beam weaponry. Now, in the later years of Tesla's life, he, each year at his birthday, would have to announce a bigger and better invention. Many of these, we believe, may have been fabrications. Many of them were not. And as far as I know, having had the microfilms of most of the material that was shipped to Yugoslavia, including the parts that were never made public, I don't think that he approached the death ray with any other technology except this highly accelerated particle beam weaponry system. Ramon, I know you're quite an expert in these fields in psychotronics. Did you have a different viewpoint on that?
Yes, sir. In fact, in the early part of this beginning of Tesla's death idea, the idea actually came about because he was standing in front of his discharge tubes, and he had lime being disintegrated. Of course, it penetrated the glass, and it would shock you. But that was basically his particle beam weapon idea. Later on, he was fortunate enough to attend a conference where a notable scientist was speaking and had the theory of electrical sound waves. Now, he had a discharge battery, storage cell, and this French scientist had a short wire and thick by cross dimension, and the other pole of the terminal. When he touched this, he created an arc. He would produce a wind, a small, minute particle that can penetrate materials. Now, this means it could even penetrate steel sheeting, which later on Tesla discovered as a way that traveled exceeding that of light. This also brings to mind the Navy and their underwater submarines. They use huge storage batteries, and they have carbon discharges. They have a breaker system that uses carbon and copper electrodes. When these are flipped, let's say a power surge, they have actually seen ball lightning coming out of the ends. Tesla's been known to have created these. So I think Tom is correct in the assumption that Tesla did indeed discover non-Hertzian waves, and that they do exceed the speed of light. And it's based on later work that he did.
I think that's correct. I sort of resurrected John Rogers' work and Hooper's work.
As a matter of fact, Rick is the one who furnished the Rogers work to me. That's where I got the original source for James Harris Rogers' work, for the Rogers undersea and underwater transmission system.
Whatever happened to that?
Ben Beck take it.
It's another one of these things that seem to vanish off the face of the earth. Ramon, what he basically did was turn a field inside out. He would shift the shield for the center conductor on what would be the equivalent of a coax cable today. When you do this, it generates some extremely interesting phenomena. There's a little bit left over, and I think this is what Tom has called to our attention as being the scalar domain. We've built some little instruments to demonstrate this, and as you probably realize, it's impossible to shield this energy with ordinary technology, either Faraday shields or magnetic shields or what have you. And I've built and demonstrated some little devices which I think most of you have seen. Let Tom address this. Tom is really up to speed on the mathematics of scalar technology and communication.
Well, Raymond, it's nice to talk to you again. I hope to see you here very shortly. I'm going to tell the audience that Raymond has done some very interesting experiments of his own. I'm not going to discuss them unless he wants to discuss them himself.
I had a feeling that Ramon knew you guys.
Super guy.
We all know Ramon. He's really done his own work.
Tesla definitely had a particle beam type weapon. He also definitely had a long involvement with transmission of energy at a distance without loss and without wires, as he so frequently said. When he said without loss, he meant 95% efficiency, 98%, something like that. He was adamant in his opposition to Hertz wave theory. He even visited Heinrich Hertz to convince him of the error of his ways, and he left there very disturbed that Hertz could not see that there could not exist such a thing as a transverse force wave in vacuum. In fact, a lot of the stuff that I've done on scalar waves started with the fact that here's a man that gave us AC electricity, he gave us the motors and generators we use, and he adamantly said there is no such thing as a Hertz wave. Well, how could, you know, these two didn't jive. So if you looked at it deep enough, you begin to see that Tesla had an awful lot of things going for him when he said you can't have a Hertz wave in vacuum. I've come to believe you cannot have such a thing. Now, I definitely believe you get a Hertz wave in the receiving antenna in the electron gas. And you have one in the transmitting antenna in the electron gas, but you don't have one in the vacuum in between. And I think that can be proven today with what we know today. But we've never gone back and re-examined the fundamentals of electromagnetics, that the basic concepts that we set out 100 years ago or so. They've just been accepted without question and passed along. And I think it's high time that all of those fundamentals got re-examined. And that's what I've been doing in a crude way. Now, when you do that, you get at something that comes out.
I wouldn't call your booklet crude.
Well, what you find is that the bits and pieces of that today do exist in physics. For example, I quoted the Baum-Aronoff paper in 1959, and there have been a series of experiments done to show that the Baum-Aronoff effect does exist. And in the West, Feynman, you know, the Nobel Prize winner, the co-founder of electrodynamics, one of the greatest physicists that's ever lived, Riley.
Two Nobel Prizes.
Right. Mm-hmm. He very wryly commented in his book about the Baum-Aronoff paper, the gee guys, it only took us 30 years to look at this, you know. In other words, the effects were already in the literature and had been there for 30 years in 1959.
Oliver Heaviside had addressed this at the end of the century.
And even today, even after that, and after a man of that stature had commented on this and even printed the results of the experiment that shows conclusively that such things exist, the Baum-Aronoff effect exists, in the West today, all that we've really done with that is sit around and say, my, look at that. And in fact, it does have severe weapon implications for weapons. We see, as I've so often said on this program, the very severe indications that the Soviets have been rapidly weaponizing this stuff for about 30 years.
And doing some very unusual and unique...
Some very unusual things.
Ramon, I picked up a copy of Wireless World a few days ago at the Circus Bookstore, and in there is an article that addresses these alternative models of electrical transmission and current. I found it extremely interesting. Suggest you go pick up one before they're all gone. Another thing that I found remarkable, when we were working on scalar technology up in Utah about 3 years ago, after meeting, one of our colleagues asked Feynman why in his MIT lecture series he said that scalar communication would be the communication of the future. It's superluminal, faster than light, cannot be shielded, etc. He had totally forgotten that he had put this information in his lectures on physics, the books published at MIT, and we've often wondered why that change of heart. Tom, do you see a conspiracy theory here?
I don't see any conspiracy theory. I think the man, as the years passed, he went on to other things, and I think he just sort of forgot what he'd written in that very early books that he had been writing.
Well, the term scalar is just now getting into the vocabulary of a number of the physicists around the country, is it not?
Well, the term scalar electromagnetics has not been used. I use that because scalar is a perfectly good term. Mm-hmm. It means that you've lost the sense of direction.